All right. I'm here with Greg Johnson of Countercurrents, and we're going to discuss the, what I'm calling the Syrian missile crisis. But, well, I don't know, how would you describe it? What term would you use for this, Greg?
I'd call it the crisis in Trump's credibility, frankly, the Trump credibility crisis.
Okay. So, well, let's begin. I suppose we can go back to last Thursday night when he ordered it on the Thursday night. I don't know if he announced it until the Friday. I can't recall.
I think he made a statement on Friday, but the missiles flew on Thursday.
Right, so it had already happened by the time it was announced. I mean, that's part of it, isn't it? How fast the whole thing unraveled. There was no time. We had that Thursday. Facebook was alive and Twitter and everywhere was alive with people worrying about what he was going to do because he'd said it was very possible that his attitude towards Assad had changed. And everyone was really worried. And then that very night, he ordered the strike. So what were your first impressions, your first thoughts?
I was appalled. I was actually hoping that maybe pushback in social media would stop this. I was really hoping that this would be stopped because it was such a dumb idea based on such trumped up non-evidence that I thought for sure that if there was enough pushback that maybe somebody would come to his or her senses around the White House and say, you hadn't ought to do this. This is a mistake. We need to slow down here, see if it actually was Assad, right? And beyond that, even if it were Assad, I don't see why it's worse to die from chemical weapons than, say, being incinerated by a bomb or being killed by a bullet. We've got this superstitious, weird notion that somehow gas is worse than any other death, which is just childish nonsense to begin with. It's more humane than being incinerated or burned with white phosphorus or all the other forms of death that are routinely meted out and do not constitute a basis for a world crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I wondered about this myself. Why is there such a moral aversion to the use of chemical weapons? And apparently, all I could find was that it goes back to the First World War when they agreed, the sides after the war agreed not to use chemical weapons because it nullifies the combat because both sides just end up gassing each other. And then I mean, I don't understand, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't understand either.
Well, one of the things I wanted to pick up on there was the speed at which it happened, because we've heard, you know, it's been said that Trump is impulsive, and the left were going on about that during the campaign.
Yeah. They said that he didn't have the temperament to govern. He didn't have the temperament to be commander in chief. And now I'm wondering if a stopped clock, you know, is right twice a day. I think they're less accurate than a stopped clock, but still, leftists can be correct about some things, and maybe Trump doesn't have the right kind of temperament. Maybe he's too impetuous, too precipitous.
Mm. Well, that implies it assumes that he made the decision, that it was he who made the decision.
And, right.
I mean, my own, well, we'll get to that later. I wouldn't be surprised if this had all been quite predetermined weeks or months in advance, or even years in advance. One thing I want to ask you is, you said that the non-evidence, the flimsy case for going to war, this is something that I didn't go into in my own video about this, so why don't you outline it here? Why do you think that it wasn't Assad who used the chemical weapons?
Well, because he's got no interest in using them. That's the thing that's so foolish, is that so implausible about the whole scenario, is that Assad would have used these weapons. Why? He knows that in the past, chemical weapons have been used as some kind of, well, I can't even think of a word for how stupid this all is, but it's used to trigger horror, paroxysms of horror and moral condemnation in normies in the West, for whatever reason that happens. It was used against Saddam Hussein. They tried to use it against Assad himself in 2013, and it didn't stick then. It was fake then. He was winning. There is absolutely no strategic advantage to using these weapons. He's winning. Why in the world would he snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory? And that's really what this threatened to do. Last week, the United States was saying that it was up to the Syrians to determine their future. The United States did not have regime change as a priority anymore. And then Assad, when everything's going his way, decides to do something that would unite the world press against him, or be used by the world press to unite the rabble against him. It just doesn't make any sense at all. But it does make perfect sense that the enemy would try and do this, because they're trying to snatch victory out of the jaws of defeat. Mm-hmm. They're trying to get the United States finally involved in this. Because maybe if the United States gets involved, maybe Assad will be pushed out, which is the agenda of the Israelis, of the international Jewish community, of the Gulf Arab states that have created and supported ISIS and all of these other Sunni fundamentalist guerrilla groups. And of course, the United States intelligence establishment, both left and right, the political parties are united on this, except for Trump. Right. He was the only one who demurred from this idea of regime change in Syria. Hillary Clinton was all for it. Mike Pence was all for it. All the chicken hawks. Obama was for it. It was a bipartisan consensus, and Trump was against it. And so were the majority of the American people.
Why are all these neocons, why are they for it? Why do they want rid of Assad?
Well, basically, because Assad is a Ba'athist, he is a secular socialist Arab nationalist who is a believer in religious tolerance. And those sorts of states, if they're ruled by the right kind of strongman, like Assad or like Saddam Hussein, or in a similar situation, but not precisely Ba'athist in its inspiration, Libya under Gaddafi, those are very good systems for Arabs to live under, for Muslims to live under. They allow stability, economic progress, social justice, and so forth. And Israel doesn't have any interest in prosperous, orderly Muslim societies in its vicinity. They're afraid of that. I believe that the ultimate goal in Iraq and the ultimate goal in Libya and the ultimate goal in Syria was not to replace these regimes with orderly democratic regimes, as if that's even possible in that part of the world. It's to replace it with chaos, in which a bunch of fundamentalist savages basically are running amok, murdering people. And that's what ISIS is. They're a Sunni fundamentalist organization. They're savagely barbarous and cruel and medieval. There really are moderate Muslims. They're the Ba'athists. Okay. There really are sensible, moderate Muslims who want to live in the modern world. They were people like Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi. And there are people like Bashar al-Assad. Israel doesn't want that. They want the region in chaos. They want it in perpetual chaos. Just enough order that maybe, the oil companies can dream about building pipelines and extracting oil from the ground. But not much more than that.
Right. So that's the Israeli Zionist reason for wanting this, for wanting rid of Assad. What about the American neocon? Are they just following the Zionist lead?
Yeah, that's basically what they are. They're just of the Zionist lobby in America, the right wing of the Zionist lobby in America. Of course, there's a left wing of the Zionist lobby in America. They all argue for the same conclusions. They just use different pretexts, basically. But you've got the left and you've got the right are basically united in doing what Israel wants, in maintaining the integrity of Israel as a Jewish state, and in knocking off all of its neighbors. And they will use different pretexts to do this, but the result is always the same. The result is always interventions and chaos and bloodshed and huge flows of refugees into Europe. It's sort of a twofer for the Israelis, for the Jewish agenda, because another part of the Jewish agenda is promoting race replacement immigration into white countries, and that's what's happening with all these migrants, these so-called refugees, many of whom are Syrians and many of whom are not, but who are coming in under the guise of being Syrian refugees.
Yeah. Yeah, which achieves the same end result for Europeans.
Yeah.
So how does Saudi Arabia fit into this?
Well, the Saudis and Qatar are both Sunni petro societies. They're basically theocracies. They're monarchies, which enforce Sharia law. And these groups are terrified of regimes like the Ba'athist regime in Syria. One has to look back in history. Iraq was a kingdom after it gained its independence in the aftermath of the Second World War. It was given its independence by the British, and they set up a monarchy. After a while, the monarchy was overthrown, and the king and a number of members of the royal family were massacred by the people who overthrew them. They were marched into a courtyard and machine gunned. Now, after this, of course, a Ba'athist government came to power. The particular coup that overthrew them wasn't Ba'athist, but it was certainly aligned with the Ba'athists. A lot of the Ba'athist founders were religious minorities like Christians. They were from a Western educated professional caste, doctors and dentists and people like that, lawyers. And they wanted to live in a modern society that was not simply a situation like the British setup, which was basically they set up these monarchs as satraps to oversee the extraction of oil wealth from these areas. All of these Gulf sheikdoms and monarchies were basically satraps of international capital, mostly the British, to oversee resource extraction by British Petroleum and this consortium of other Western societies. And when you had these secular, socialist, nationalist parties emerge to try and take control of the natural resources of the nation, distribute them equitably amongst the people, use this enormous natural wealth as basically a way to capitalize modernization. The petro monarchies were terrified of that. There was a similar movement in Iran that was put down by the CIA. That is really the great struggle between different forms of Arab government in the Middle East. It's the modernizers, the socialists, and the advocates of religious tolerance on the one hand, and the usually fervently Sunni petro monarchies on the other hand. And so they work very, very hard to destabilize any kind of Ba'athist regime. They worked against it in Egypt. They worked against it in Iraq, and they worked against it in Syria.
Right. Okay.
It just simply because it's the model that is most threatening to them. And all of these Gulf Arab sheikhs, they all know what happened to the royals in Iraq. And someday, I think that I kind of look forward to it this day, but I would love it if I woke up one morning and found out that there was a Ba'athist colonel who had pulled a coup in a country like Qatar or Saudi Arabia and machine gunned a bunch of royals. I mean, that would send the world petro markets, the world financial markets, the capital, you know, the cabinets of all, most Western countries into total turmoil. It would be a total meltdown, which I kind of would relish because it's bad for the system that's ruining us. But yeah, so they're very worried about people like Assad, and they work to undermine people like Assad. And to do that, they unleash the fanaticism of Sunni Islamists who want nothing more than to slaughter groups like the Yazidis or the Christians or the Alawites or the Druze, either non-Muslim groups or these heretical Muslim groups or quasi-Muslim groups. All of these groups will be slaughtered, just like the Copts are being attacked in Egypt. When the Mubarak regime, which was basically an heir to the Ba'athist approach in Egypt, was overthrown under Obama, by this, you know, Arab Spring. Basically what happened is once they had a quote-unquote democracy, attacks by Islamists against the Coptic Christian minority went through the roof. You know, these people were going to be forced into exile or slaughtered. And what happened with the coup that put the military back in charge and put this al-Sisi guy in power, is it put a cap on that? They started hunting down ISIS and the Muslim Brotherhood and groups like this and stopping it. But still, there's a low-scale insurgency going on in Egypt. And this bombing against the Copts just recently is an example of that.
Right, okay. To get back onto the topic of Syria, I wanted to ask, what about the petrodollar? Do you think that fits into this?
I think not, for this reason. First of all, the petrodollar theory is the idea that anytime some government decides they don't want to use the U.S. dollar as the world reserve of the reserve currency, that the United States wants to bump them off. And that's why it happens. You know, basically it's promoting the idea that that is somehow the deciding factor. The necessity of maintaining the value of the U.S. dollar. The U.S. can print huge amounts of currency because a lot of it is held in reserves by foreign banks rather than spent, because it's sort of the world reserve currency for making major transfers and transactions between states. And, you know, oil purchases are denominated in dollars, et cetera, et cetera. I think that a lot of that is basically an ad hoc theory that is adopted by advocates of basically Austrian economics and anybody else who has a basic quantitative theory of money, which holds that the more money you print, the less value the money has because of inflation. Huge amounts of money have been printed since 2008. Trillions of dollars have basically been created in the United States, in all the bailouts and so forth that came in the aftermath of the big downturn in 2008, the beginning of our current depression. And if the quantitative theory of money is true, if you add trillions of dollars into circulation, there should be hyperinflation, but there wasn't any. Right.
Right. Okay.
And instead of concluding that their theory of money and inflation is false, they just come up with ad hoc hypotheses to explain this. And so they claim that, well, it's all being sopped up by banks and held in reserve, and therefore it's not being spent. But it is being spent. It is being spent. If petrol is denominated in dollars, it is being spent. And then, of course, part of the sort of conspiratorialism that goes along with this is claiming that the whole system depends on keeping the petrodollar, right? And that they're willing to start wars and overthrow governments to do that. I think that is a projection of people who are clinging to basically what is a refuted theory about money and inflation. So I'm somewhat dismissive of that. Now, that doesn't mean that people who are making decisions in Washington don't have the same stupid views about money. They have very stupid views about money, not the same views as the Austrian economics types who retail this. So my feeling is that that's probably not a decisive factor. It's I think a kind of marginal and cranky conspiracy theory. I also think that the people who want to relate everything to the oil markets and pipelines and things like that, it's plausible superficially, which is why it sticks around, but I don't think it's the ultimate explanation for these policies, for the simple reason that oil can flow through and be transported through all kinds of different, you know, mediums and routes. The whole world doesn't depend on whether there's a pipeline that goes across Syria or not. You know, and they want to ascribe too much importance, I think, to pipeline schemes and stuff like that. Because and I just don't think that that explains everything. Ultimately, what's driving this is ethnic politics. It's not dollar politics. It's not oil politics. It's ethnic politics. And the decisive factor in that part of the world is really Israel. That is the power that can throw the United States foreign policy around like a rag doll. These are the people who find it very, very easy to get the United States to fight wars and engage in interventions and so forth to the benefit of Israel and the Jewish community globally. I think that's really the decisive factor here. And I think that, of course, the petrol monarchies do have their interests and have been mobilized in this endeavor to oust Assad. They've got their own very petty concerns, which I've outlined, I think, basically the fear that his system and what he represents is the antithesis of their system, which is true. And yet I think that the ultimate thing that sort of puts this coalition together and animates it really is the power of the Jewish lobby worldwide and in the United States. It really does basically control U.S. foreign policy. And they were very, very successful in getting the United States into a catastrophic multi-trillion dollar war. And, you know, we're just not ready to fight any more catastrophic multi-trillion dollar wars yet. But they're trying to entrap us and goad us into that with Syria and ultimately Iran. Bill Kristol said the big prize is regime change in Iran. That's what he most recently said this after he expressed his approval of the airstrike in Syria.
Right. Okay. One more thing before we get onto the, I want to go onto the Trump cabinet, the Trump government, but one more thing before that. Do you believe that this was a sarin attack or sarin incident? Because there is this suspicion among some quarters that it isn't, that the entire thing was actually fake, because there's this footage of people who are supposedly handling the victims and they're not using gloves or anything, and apparently that's insane if you're dealing with a sarin attack. So what do you think about this?
It's fishy. It's definitely fishy. I think the most plausible explanation is that the Syrian government dropped a bomb and it hit a munitions supply dump where the rebel groups, the enemy groups, were storing chemicals, chemical weapons, something like that. That they basically blew up a supply of chemical weapons or their precursors. Maybe it's a place where they were manufacturing chemical weapons or just storing completed chemical weapons. And it got blown up and it got spread around and it killed some people.
Right, okay, okay.
Whether it was Saren or not, doesn't seem likely it was Saren. And of course, what could very well have happened is a bunch of people could have been killed by sarin gas, but the film footage that we see could be entirely fake.
Mm. It's this thing about the white helmets.
Yeah, because we know that they are some kind of op, right? They've been involved in basically fake atrocity coverage and things like that in the past. We know that. I mean, I think there's very little reason to think that these people are anything else but a part of a, you know, anti-Assad propaganda operations funded by NGOs or the United States government itself or the Gulf states or whoever. It doesn't really matter because the end is always the same.
Right. Okay. Well, let's move on to the background to this in terms of the American context and why this is so disappointing for the alt-right, this strike, this missile strike. Let's go back to September, October, November. There was a sense that Trump was going to move the Republican Party very far away after the RNC, the Republican National Convention. There was a sense that he was going to move it into a new era and disassociate from all of those figures from the past. Now, what do you think went wrong?
There just weren't enough people to fill an administration, basically. I mean, everyone knew that the whole point was that he was trying to create a... He wanted... to create a government that reflected his vision. He was looking for people who are not necessarily Republicans, and he was getting advice from people in New York City's financial industry and business industry. Well, he was and ended up with people from Goldman Sachs that way. And these people from Goldman Sachs arrived with whole retinues of other people that they brought in. And the Cuck Republican Network and the Jewish Network, of course, were there. There were existing networks that were basically feeding people into the administration. And so the government, the thousands of positions that the Trump administration has to fill, were filled with people who represent the bad old thinking that he was trying to get away from. And he ended up being surrounded by people whose thinking is far more conventional than his. And I just think that now he's boxed in. He's getting a lot of bad advice. He's getting a lot of bad conventional advice from people whose brains have been stocked with neocon talking points, basically. And once they're ensconced, they're going to start feeding him stuff that reflects their stale point of view. And a lot of these people are completely duplicitous and sneaky, and they're going to try and inflect the administration back in the direction of globalism any way they can. And of course, they're just going to tell lies. That's one of the ways that these people work. That's how they got us in the Gulf War to begin with. They told lies. John McCain talks every day to this McMaster character. That's the big problem. I don't even think Jared Kushner is necessarily that big a problem compared to Madison McMaster, who are wired into people like McCain, who are wired into the entire neocon network and are pushing the neocon agenda. Trump really needed to find a few thousand populist nationalists who understood his vision and who are competent to do jobs in the administration. And basically he got Steve Bannon and one or two other people. That's all he got. This is a problem that I predicted. It was a problem that I urged people who know Trump to try and impress upon him that he has to recruit people outside the mainstream if he wants his agenda to move forward. Otherwise, he will be stopped at every turn by basically cucks and liberals who are embedded in the government institutions or who will come in on his coattails. And it just wasn't to be. It just didn't happen. There just weren't enough people. And the good people that were there and willing to serve, you know, they put their hats in the ring, but there were networks in place of establishment types, conventional thinkers that could move their people into positions. And now they're feeding him information to try and deflect the populist nationalist direction of his administration back towards globalism, elitism, and the old paradigm. And they're succeeding, if this missile strike is any indication. Mm. And they're succeeding so rapidly and so easily that it really undermines my sense of Trump's character. That's why I call this the crisis about Trump's character. The Trump credibility crisis is what we're dealing with. This is just profoundly disturbing to see how quickly he can be brought to do 180 degrees and to do it so stupidly and clumsily. This buffoonish stuff about, oh, the little children and all that. Is this the guy that we elected? It just seems like the swamp has swallowed him up, as some people put it. It's profoundly disturbing. But it's good in a way, because a lot of people in the alt-right were expecting too much from Trump. And we need to get back on point, basically. We need to get back at our real agenda, which is not Trump. It's something far bigger and better and beyond Trump. And Trump has unleashed a lot of nationalist and populist and racialist forces that are bigger than him and are going to, it's like a great storm. It's going to go howling on into the future, long after Trump is dead. And we need to ride that wave and direct that wave. That's what we need to be doing now. And we do not need to have all of our hopes pinned to the ups and downs of the Trump administration. If Trump fails, if he betrays us, it's not over. All those people who put him in office are going to be demanding something more radical than Trump. And I do think that American politics is going to change, and it's going to change forever because of him. And it's really our job to make sure that it changes forever, that this is not reversible, that we cannot allow these people to ratchet things back to the way they were before.
I don't think they have there isn't the material with which they could do that, because, you know, the way things were before was predicated on a comfortable majority white, prosperous American population.
Yeah.
Well, that's not going to be the case 5-10 years from now.
It's not the case now.
No, it's not the case now. But as the demographics advance, then, you know.
The demographic problems are only going to get worse if Trump does nothing about it. The reason why we stand for what we stand for is because we know that multiculturalism is not consistent with a first world society. America will not be a world power if this multicultural agenda keeps pushing forward. That's simply the bottom line. And what we have to do is make people aware of all they are going to lose if multiculturalism is not stopped, to get the people who have lost things, and especially the people who have nothing left to lose, organized and really, really angry, and get the populace with their pitchforks out there, and create an insurgency in the political system. That's what Trump was. Trump got into power by riding a wave of discontent. And if he doesn't satisfy these people, their discontent is only going to grow, and it's only going to fracture the system more. And that's what we really need to start doing. We need to start agitating to all the contradictions, all the discontents that put Trump into office. We've got to keep picking at those wounds. We got to keep rubbing salt in them. We've got to get people awake. We've got to get people angry. We've got to get people organized. There will be other politicians who will come along who are going to try and ride this wave into power, if only because they're ambitious sociopaths. And better yet, they're going to be people who go into politics who really believe what we believe. So this is not over with Trump. And honestly, I think we're better off getting disillusioned with him quickly, so we can put all of our energy into agitating for the next step and the next step, moving the goalposts and so forth. Rather than cheerleading Trump, we need to start being his opposition. And I said this from the very beginning. We need to be his loyal opposition in the sense that we don't want to destroy him. We want to help him. But we're opposed to him because we're further ahead than him, right?
Yeah.
We want some of the things that he wants, but he doesn't want the stuff that we want yet. And we want to help him as much as we can, mobilize support for his policies, and we want to give economic and moral and historical cases for populist socialist or populist nationalist policies, and things like, well, just frankly, things like single-payer medicine and stuff like that. Actual socialist stuff, I think, wouldn't be bad. And we need to move forward on that, but we also need to capture the minds of people and get them to see that there's something beyond Trump, and we have to bring them to a racial nationalist outlook. That's what we want to do.
Right, okay. You sound quite fired up.
Well, yeah, I am. I am.
It's good, because I mean, a lot of us are very despondent.
I'm not depressed. I'm not depressed or black-pilled, and I'm not wasting my time coming up with 88-dimensional chess nonsense about how this is really some extremely clever ruse. It's not clever to betray your most ardent supporters in a stupid, clumsy way like this. There's nothing clever about this. There's no upside to this. I refuse to think that Trump's playing some really, really clever thing, because basically, no matter what happens, he's not going to get back the support of the people who are most ardent in supporting him and arguing for him. He's not going to get that back. It's not going to happen. We're not going to trust him anymore. We're going to look at him in a very jaundiced way from now on. Now, some people might go back to him out of affection. I mean, as I put it, if he breaks every other promise, he's still the guy who got leftists to go around dressed up as vaginas. I mean, that's hilarious. That's hilarious. And I'm grateful for that, right?
Yeah.
Even if he breaks every other promise, he's still done tremendous stuff just by getting his enemies to go completely insane. But we want more and we deserve more. And we're not going to trust this guy anymore. And that means we're going to take things back into our own hands, which is what we should have been doing all along anyway. It's our job to make history. It's our job to create a future again for white people, because white people in every white country do not have a future if the current trends continue. We wanted Trump because he promised to interrupt some of those alarming trends. And if he doesn't do it, or if he falters in doing it, we're going to find somebody else who will do it for us. But we've got to get back on track in thinking about how we are going to create a future for white people again. And we need to recognize that it's our movement, not Trump, who's just a civic nationalist, who really represents the long-term interests of our race. You know, we're a government in exile. Okay, or we got to start acting like it.
Right.
And we have to start acting like the elders of our race, not a bunch of silly kids, right? The wise elders of our race, you know, the elders of Albion and all the other countries of the white world. We have to start acting like that, because that's what we aspire to be.
Excellent. All right. Well, those are very inspiring words. I hope people take them to heart. I think we'll end it there.